Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. We live in a time in which eliminating suffering is considered by many to be society's ultimate purpose. Too often, this leads to policies that eliminate suffering by eliminating the sufferer. Still, for those not experiencing intense pain or anguish, arguing for improved care instead of increased access to assisted suicide or euthanasia can seem like a blithe platitude. If you were really suffering, I've heard repeatedly in my more than 30 years involved with these issues, you would sing a different tune. Perhaps. But many people who suffer intensely sing from the same songbook. One is my good friend and guest for this episode of Humanize, Mark Pickup. Pickup has experienced the intense terror and anguish caused by disabling and progressive multiple sclerosis over several decades. Yet in the midst of his intense pain, he became one of North America's most prominent public speakers, seeking to help others maneuver their way through travail and to find meaning even in the most difficult life circumstances. He is also a noted Christian apologist. Pickup has addressed politicians in Canada and the United States, churches and denominational leaders, universities, high schools and community groups, hospital medical staffs, local, state, and provincial pro-life conventions, as well as keynote speaker to U.S. National Right to Life prayer breakfasts. Pickup is extensively published in Canadian and U.S. media and has appeared on innumerable radio and television programs warning against a cultural drift toward euthanasia acceptance. Mark has received numerous awards for his work, including the Monsignor Bill Irwin Award for Ethical Excellence and a Governor General's Medal for Community Service. He writes the Human Life Matters blog that deals with issues of the sanctity of human life and other matters of cultural concern. Mark, welcome to Humanize.
Thank you for having me on your show, Wesley.
Well, it's great to see you. We can see each other on a stream, but it's also great to hear you. You know, you've been an activist for decades. Why did you decide to devote yourself to sanctity of life issues?
Well, I decided to dedicate myself to the sanctity of human life long before the disability came. It's something I'm not proud to admit, but my wife and I aborted our first child way back in '72. That grief haunted me for quite some time, and eventually, I guess I was just driven by guilt to become involved with the abortion issue, because I didn't want others to go down the same path that we did. That occupied many of my first years in the pro-life movement, was dealing with the issue of abortion, first in Canada, and then later on in the United States. You got to remember that Canada legalized abortion before the United States did. We did it in 69, you did it in 73. So that was really the essence of how I got started. I was brought up to believe that every life is sacred. And that was what
Can I ask why you both decided to go that route, which you now regret so deeply?
You know, my father, he had a book on the life a series of books that were out in the 60s. There were different topics, mathematics, physics, growth, the mind. And in the growth book, just got to remember, this is 1965 when that was published. So the photographs that were taken before 65, they showed by very early fiber optic photography the growth of a child from conception through to birth. And I can remember looking at those things, being absolutely amazed at this child developing in the womb. And when it came time that my girlfriend, now wife, became pregnant with our baby, I sort of just threw that stuff that I knew out the window, because I wanted a party. I didn't want to be a dad. I was 18 years old. I didn't want it. And so I took the coward's way out and pressured my wife, Larie, my girlfriend then, to have an abortion. She didn't want to have this. She wanted to have the abortion. She wanted to have the child, that we would raise this child together. I didn't want it. And so if there's blood to be had, it's on my hands alone. And I pressured her into that abortion big time. But that inkling, that kernel of knowledge that was given to me earlier, I knew that that was not a blob of tissue. I knew that wasn't potential life. I knew that was life with potential. And I couldn't shake it. I just could not shake it. And, I became the director of family services for two communities later on. And even then, in the early 1980s, I was still trying to deny that what I had done was kill my child. I didn't pull the trigger, but I sure gave the bullets. And I can remember even inviting Planned Parenthood to the community, to my communities, to spew their filth out into to our kids. And it wasn't until I became a Christian in 80, I guess. And by 82, my conscience was so affected by what I was doing and what I had done that I eventually just gave in and said, okay, I was wrong. I had to confess that. And for anyone who's listening, yes, there is forgiveness for abortion. We can't change the consequences of what happened, but we can change the fact that we're forgiven. And that was the start of my work with the pro-life community. And one of the first things that I did was help to co-fund the Pregnancy Care Center that got up and running in 83, 84, and has saved literally tens of thousands of women from the same agony that Larie and I went through. Not to mention helped them with their children, and to set up their lives, help them get going, get training for an occupation, find a home, all those sorts of things that one has to deal with during pregnancy and preparing for a child. Can I share a short story with you about that, what happened?
Sure.
When we were first starting this center up in Edmonton, I got a phone call. We weren't even up and running yet. I don't even think we had our charitable status, or if we did, we just had it. And I got a phone call from a woman, and she said, I hear you're starting a pregnancy center. I've got some clothes. My children are about 1.5 now, and I have some clothes and stuff for babies. Can you use it? And I said, sure. Can I come and get it? And the night before I went to go get the clothing from this woman, my sister-in-law came to the house, and she was pregnant. She was 18. And Larie and I sat, and we talked to her and tried to convince her that abortion was not the way out. And she looked at me, and she said, you know, what am I supposed to do with a child? I got no job. I got no place. I don't even have a vacuum to vacuum my house with. And I said, I don't know, Casey. I honestly don't know how this will work, but I know that if you choose life, that God will honor that. And so she sort of calmed down and went away that night. The next morning, I went to get this this clothing that I thought was clothing for a baby. And this lady pulls up in her Suburban. She opens the back doors of the Suburban, and there was a line of baby girl clothes with a baby, starting with a baby girl diaper pail. That's back when they used to use diapers, and baby clothing right up to the age of one. And on the right side was a baby boy with a blue diaper pail with clothes and diapers and all kinds of things that went right up to age of one. And I said, well, this is wonderful. Thank you, madam. And then she pulls out this vacuum and she says, do you know anybody can use one of these things? And I said, I sure do. So what I did is I took home all this stuff, and I spread all the clothing out in the rumpus room that we had. And I put the vacuum cleaner right in the middle of the room. And I called up Casey, the girl who had come to say she was pregnant. I said, come over here, quick. So she came over and she went into the rumpus room and she saw the vacuum there and she just went down on her knee and he just started to cry. And I said, you see, God takes care of us. I don't know how he does it, but he does it. And that little boy is now a 40-year-old man. He's a successful businessman in Edmonton. And that was the story. And from there on, right to this day, that center is working, serving women in crisis pregnancies.
How did you switch your primary emphasis, if that's the right word, to euthanasia?
Well, that happened when my own diagnosis in 84 of multiple sclerosis. Mm-hmm. And I was so sick that I really couldn't do much. I had to resign from the board of the pregnancy center. And for a little while, I was just too sick to deal with it.
You know, I think this is an important point because we continually hear about how the best way to handle suffering is to allow people the autonomy or the choice to die in their own terms and this kind of thing. And you were, as I understand it, you were an executive for the in the media, correct?
Executive of what?
In the media, in the CBC Center.
Well, I wasn't executive, but I did work there. Yeah. I was a writer for them.
And you were diagnosed, and to describe in a little bit of detail how hard this thing hit you.
Well, it was just horrible. The diagnosis itself was a shock. Now, I want to also give it a bit of an aside here. In 82, in Canada, we had a major recession, and I landed up out of work. And so I was pounding the pavement every day trying to find a job. Unsuccessfully, and I got home one night, and Larry said to me, somebody from this organization called, they want an interview with you. And I said, well, I didn't send a resume to them. I didn't even go to their place. Now, I know this is going to sound too fantastic, and I'll swear to Bible it happened, but Larry looked at me, and with her usual wisdom, said, you don't look a gift horse in the mouth. You can't find a job. So I went to this interview, and Larry and I worked out how much we needed to survive with two children. And so I went to the interview, and despite the fact of me telling them I didn't know anything about their disease, and despite the fact that I told them they probably couldn't afford to have me anyway, they offered me the job as community services coordinator for the Multiple Sclerosis Society of Edmonton.
This is before you're diagnosed.
I took the job.
This is before you're diagnosed.
Before I was diagnosed. This was in 82. I wasn't diagnosed till 84. So for 6 months, I saw the very worst that MS can deal out, because only the people who were the sickest tended to come to the MS Society. I saw young people whose lives were destroyed, their careers destroyed, their marriages destroyed. Everything was gone. I saw there was a man who came into the office, and he had his daughter was bedridden with MS, and he said to me, "I hear what these remissions, they're going to happen, aren't they?" And I couldn't say they were. They often do, but they don't always, depending on the type of MS you have. And I couldn't say anything to him, and he was desperate for an answer for his daughter. Well, that girl was, like I say, bedridden. At 9 months, she was blind. At 2 years, she was dead. That was just the kind of thing I had to deal with. I would go to people's houses, and they would be alone because their mate left them, and they would be in the dark in these wheelchairs. And I didn't know how to comfort these folks. They wanted to die, and all I could do was look at my shoes. I couldn't take it, Wesley. I left that job after 6 months, and I went to the cushy federal civil service. But I didn't understand what the point of that was. Then in 1984, I myself was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. Well, you can imagine what kind of terror that brings along, because I saw the very worst that it can deal out when I was with the MS Society. My wife and I dealt with such a roller coaster, raucous ride with this disease. I would, my vision would be affected, and I would get it back. My hearing was affected. I would go spastic. I would lose the use of my legs or my arms. I would go incontinent. And all these symptoms would all these symptoms would come on, and when they would abate, they would come back, but not totally. I would always be left with some deficits.
So it was just like two steps back, one step forward, yeah, two steps right. back, and, one step forward.
I knew that. And so gradually, this creeping paralysis started to happen, and I would come back. But eventually, the remissions were less and less. And as time went on, I started losing more and more function, and the remissions became less and less. And by the time, this would be the late 80s, I was using cane and then canes and then a walker and eventually a wheelchair and then electric wheelchair. And that's pretty much how it was for the last number of years.
Let me interrupt this. I think it's important that people hear what you're saying, because too often when people experience the kind of extreme difficulty you did, we're told that death is the answer, and yet you went in the other direction. I take it right now, as a matter of fact, in Canada, because you still have multiple sclerosis, and we'll get into what happened to you towards the last couple of years, toward the end of this interview. But you would, if you said I'm suffering unbearably, you would qualify right now to be killed, wouldn't you?
You know, Wesley, that's a really important point. We don't need life with death with dignity. We need life with dignity. That is the whole point. If I had not been surrounded by a family that loves me, and a God who loves me, and a community that supports me, I would have probably opted for assisted suicide. But that is not what I needed. I needed support to raise me up as someone of value, even when I doubted my own value.
So I needed let's focus on this. At your greatest despair, which one can totally comprehend when you're blind one day, you wake up the next day, you're not blind, then you're blind again. You're growing progressively disabled. That's incredibly difficult. And this is the time when sometimes people will say, well, there's no point in going on. And you say the reason you were able not to fall into that dark well was because you had support. Is that right?
Support. There was this, let me use a community of concern that cared about me. And when the times were needed, cared for me. It was that love that lifted me up. Even when I didn't care if I was lifted up. And that's it. That is an important thing, because that is what a community is. That is what a community does. What we're now talking about is autonomy. That is the king. I get to make the choice that I can be euthanized at any point I want. But when I make that decision to be euthanized, it doesn't affect just me, Wesley. It affects my wife. It affects my doctor, because I'll ask her to stop being my healer and become my killer. It will affect my children. It will affect my community. And my nation too, by helping to entrench the notion that there is such a thing as a life that is not worthy to be lived. That is what Canada is now saying to its people who are disabled and or have sunk beneath the waves of their circumstances with depression or circumstances. Your life is not worth it.
You're a disability rights activist, and you're saying, as if I hear you right, that this whole euthanasia idea that killing is compassion is actually sending the opposite message.
Absolutely.
That it's an abandoning message, that you're right, your life isn't worth living. When you were in your darkest moments, you needed to be told and helped to find that your life was worth living.
That's exactly what I needed. I didn't need someone to, think about it. If someone says, I don't want to live anymore, I'm going to kill myself. If a person says, maybe you don't want to hang yourself because it doesn't always work. Maybe you should shoot yourself. I'll give you the bullets. That isn't what you need to hear. At that point, you need to receive help, perhaps psychiatric help, perhaps even to be committed to a psychiatric facility until the crisis passes. But you do not need affirmation that, yes, you should maybe kill yourself. That is
if you had, been, of course, when this happened to you, euthanasia wasn't legal in Canada. But had it been legal, if you can cast yourself back to your mindset then, how would that have impacted your thinking in terms of going forward?
I remember just at the time that I was diagnosed, just right around that point, there was a woman in Canada by the name of Sue Rodriguez.
And yeah, she had Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS.
She had Lou Gehrig's disease. She wanted assisted suicide, and she took it all the way up to the Supreme Court. I can remember her sitting on the steps of this, of the Canadian Supreme Court building, and saying that what she wanted was something that people with severe disabilities wanted. And I can remember thinking to her, that doesn't talk for me. That doesn't talk for me at all. I don't want this death with dignity. I just want to live a life with dignity. Now, to be fair to Sue, she did not have support. Or the support that they said she had, it was pretty peripheral. It was pretty weak. The real support that she had was to kill herself, because the Death with Dignity crowd was using her as an example. Much like this, the same way that Norma McCorvey was used to legalize abortion in the States. Well, Sue Rodriguez did that in Canada. Happily, it didn't happen right away. That would be 92, maybe? Canada didn't legalize assisted suicide until 2016. But at the time, they were saying Canada was struck a Senate committee that was going to examine the issue, and I can remember appearing before them, and basically I was saying is, don't do this. This is not helping people with disabilities. This, in fact, is calling us useless eaters. You're going to get rid of us. What does that mean? That means that people with healthy that are healthy or suicidal, they get counseling. People that are disabled that are suicidal, they get help killing themselves. Where's the equality in that? Now, happily, the government of Canada did not go. The Senate did not recommend euthanasia to Canada at that time. They said we weren't ready. I guess that means that we hadn't been massaged enough. Our consciences hadn't been dulled enough until 2015, when the Supreme Court struck down the laws that dealt with assisted suicide in Canada. And then the next year, the Liberal government, and I won't mention Justin Trudeau by name, but his government legalized assisted suicide, which they euphemistically called medical assistance in dying, MAID, as they like to call it. Always beware of someone who uses euphemisms, because you have to then ask, what are they trying to hide? What unpleasant phrase are they trying, an act are they trying to disguise under flowery language? Well, it's assisted killing is what it is. It isn't assistance in dying, because within a year and a half, and we knew in the disabled community, we knew that it always starts with a something that is almost acceptable with the public, and then it begins to degenerate. It goes down in segments. The very next, within 2 years, the requirement to have a death that was reasonably foreseeable, that was in the original legislation, was removed. Now, what we had was the sights turned to people with disabilities. We knew that was going to happen. And that's what it is now. It isn't just for the terminally ill. It never was. That was just a ruse to get the idea going. And now we have the disabled. And as you know, Wesley, that we, last, as of, what was it, 2024, this month, they were going to legalize assisted suicide for the mentally ill. You know, I could barely bring myself to say that. What kind of a civilized society helps their mentally ill commit suicide? But they were going to do that. Then they brushed it off till this year. And the public hadn't been massaged enough yet to accept it, because the public just wasn't buying it. And so last month, they moved the commencement date for helping the mentally ill that are depressed kill themselves to 2027. But that just means it's been postponed. That doesn't mean it's been canned.
Yeah. One of the things that has shocked me tremendously is how enthusiastically Canada has embraced this euthanasia agenda. Why do you think that is? Because Canada is a, when one thinks of Canada, at least from the States, as kind of this enlightened, friendly, caring place. And yet you all have, not you all, not everyone, obviously, but certainly large majorities embrace this killing agenda. What happened, do you think? And what lessons do we have here in the States about that?
I wrote an article for the Human Life Review under the title, Evil Advances in Increments. That's how it happened. There was a time not all that long ago when this would have been completely unthinkable to the Canadian public. And I think it began at the point that you open the door to the concept that there are some lives that are expendable. There are some lives that are unwanted. There are some lives that perhaps are not worthy to be lived. That began with abortion. That was the thin edge of the wedge. And nobody could even conceive that that would eventually move into killing off the disabled. But there were people who hearkened that prophecy back in the early days in Canada after abortion was legalized. They were laughed at as fanatics. But that is where it began. It evil advances in increments. That's how it works. You can't just present an outrageous idea right off the bat to a civilized society and expect them to accept it. You have to introduce it in parts and always couch it in compassionate terms. Don't ever talk about the vast majority of abortions which are done out of convenience or unwantedness. Talk about the incest and the rape. Talk about that tiny minority of abortions and then make policy based on the exceptions. Laws that are made on the basis of acceptance are never good laws. And so what that did is that then they began to present cases of desperate, terrible cases of people with disabilities who wanted to die. And, of course, the public would look at it and say, oh, poor guy.
I'd probably want to be dead, too.
Yeah, those cases. And they present the most extreme, of course. And that's how they began to do it. It was just a slow step by slow step by slow step. And one day you wake up and wonder, how did we get to this point? But it came little pieces by little pieces. And that's exactly what was happening in the United States. It happened, began again with abortion. And of course, it was couched on the most desperate cases of a woman who was supposedly gang raped, which was a lie. So they present this extreme case. And then they talk about the 10-year-old who got pregnant. That does happen on occasion, but very rare. But those are the extreme cases they presented, when in fact they wanted it for the whole of the population. So that was how it was introduced to the most civilized nation in the world, the United States of America. I love the United States of America. But even that beacon on the hill, there were things that happened that began to make the light dimmer and dimmer. One of those things was the abandonment of God. In God we trust. On your coinage. That was abandoned. And I cannot emphasize more than that. That probably was the single biggest abandonment and change for the worst that your country and my country did, was because when you abandon God, then you become your own God. You set your own standards. Your right, my right, your truth, my truth. There is no the truth. That was what happened during the 60s and 70s. You remember all those arguments that came out at that time when the sexual revolution came out. Well, one of the results of the sexual revolution was, of course, unwanted pregnancies. But we bought into the, if it feels good, do it. Don't knock it till you tried it. That was meant to promote illegal use of drugs. The if it feels good, do it was meant to promote sex outside of marriage. These were the slogans that came along. Medical assistance in dying was just another slogan to promote the piece farther down the road. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question, because you know you've talked a lot about your faith, which you know is deep and profound and an important part of your life. And you've talked about how that has helped you cope with suffering and how being embraced during the worst times of your travail while you were, you've once called it wild MS to me, when it was just like this wild ride. But you and your wife have actually traveled and spoken about how to deal with intense suffering more generally. What advice do you have for somebody who might not have your faith? You know, that faith is not something that necessarily comes easily for people. And you know, you've been working it for many years, but there are a lot of people listening who say, well, what does that have to do with me? Because that's not where I am. I'm agnostic or I don't
believe in God. It has everything to do with them. Because they too are citizens. They too belong to a nation. This is not a place, we do not live in an autonomous world. Words like community, nation, all allude to the fact that we are interdependent, not independent. Even if you're not a Christian or a person of any faith, you are still a citizen with responsibilities. If we want freedoms, freedoms come with responsibilities. I do not have a right, for my own comfort and my own sake, to cheapen life in the context of a community and a society. I do not have that right. What I do have a right to is good palliative care. What I do have a right to is support within my community.
Inclusion.
Inclusion. But I do not have a right to...
Now, this is very interesting because rarely do we hear this argument that you're making. Usually it's, you know, and I make this argument that our obligation is to help the person going through the difficulty. But you're saying that the person going through the difficulty also has an obligation in the midst of his or her difficulty.
That's right. Their citizenship never stops just because they're suffering. They still have an obligation to the whole, not only to themselves. In fact, they probably have an obligation to the whole more than they have to themselves. Yes, I know what it feels like to be terrified, to be in pain. But that did not cancel my duty to my neighbor.
So you're saying that even in the midst of, we'll say, terminal cancer,
yes,
or the midst of advancing multiple sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, even though you're suffering terribly, you still owe an obligation to your family and to your community. As I sometimes put it, it's to be a gracious recipient of care.
Yes.
Because when you receive care, you're allowing other people to plant seeds of love and inclusion. But if we're constantly rejecting it, how can people do that?
Well, that's exactly what it is. And whenever we have, if I were to choose assisted suicide, my neighbor down the street who had rheumatoid arthritis, terrible rheumatoid arthritis, then he too might say, well, that's an option for me. Then I become a partner in his death.
Yes, this is what the media is doing in many of their stories. They're normalizing the idea of killing as an acceptable answer to human suffering. And when you have media and even family members saying, well, he died on his own terms, you're basically planting the seed because suicide is contagious.
Yes.
And in this regard, I think the media has been doing a terrible disservice to people going through difficulties by basically sending the message that that's the better course.
You know, it's interesting that you say that, Wesley. I did an interview recently with a local television station, and it was regarding assisted suicide. And a reporter came in, and she looked at what I was saying, which was essentially what I've been saying to you. Her first comment was, so you don't believe in autonomy? And I said, I thought I was doing the interview, not you. So, but that's where she came on. She kept coming back with this, so you don't believe in personal choice? I said, no, I believe in community first, and then choice second. But that's what they were coming from. This has been intentional by the media. She was only an example of a larger contagion that's going on within the media. They know what they're doing. They were promoting autonomy versus community.
How do you help people deal with something we hear all the time? I'm worried about being a burden. We hear that. My mother said it to me when we were caring for my mother, my wife and I. You know, this fear of being a burden, I think, is something that is very insidious, and which we all can relate to, because none of us want to cause other people to have difficulty and so forth. So how do you handle that fear and that concern?
Well, let me ask you a question at a personal level. Your mother didn't want to be a burden. God bless her. Did you think she was a burden?
No, I didn't think she was a burden, but you know, sometimes caring for her was difficult, but that didn't make her a burden.
That's right. It is not a burden. It is, in fact, a blessing for those who provide the care, because it calls them to a higher standard of love. It calls them out of self to look to the other. And this brings me to the next point. We also hear about the person who is comatose on a respirator, that they really have no life. Let's just end it now. My comment to that is, no. You think that their life has no value. It gives nothing to the whole, but that is not true. When we care for someone who is in a coma, they may not know, probably don't know, that we're helping them. They don't know that we're caring for them. They don't know that we're giving them love. But we do. They, in their silence, are calling us to that higher standard of human love that perhaps only they can give. They and a small child.
I think Lincoln called that the better angels of our nature.
Then they are. We need to call to those higher angels, rather than sink to our lower devils and killing off people who are unwanted or disabled or mentally ill, is feeding the lower devils.
And again, this is regardless of whether one has faith. Is that right?
Whether one is, what was that?
This is regardless of whether one has faith. You're talking about...
This is. I'm talking about community. I'm talking about interdependence. I'm talking about the human family.
Being a forest, not just a bunch of trees standing next to each other.
That's right. This is the human family.
Certainly, one does not have to have faith to be a loving and caring person.
No.
In fact, that's part of the human ideal. And you're saying that that. If somebody wants to end it all because they're suffering and they want to bring their families into that decision and that action and doctors and the entire society, that they are not only doing a disservice to themselves, but to their community and to their families and to basically humanity itself, because you're turning away from that loving embrace that you're describing.
Was it not John Donne who said, never ask to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee, that every man's death affects us, that we are interconnected, whether we know it or not, we are. Otherwise, we have a jungle.
So, what advice do you give to people who experience a devastating diagnosis,
right?
A terrible injury, a terrible disease that's going to impact them in the rest of their lives. When you are talking to people who are experiencing this, because you've been through it, I haven't been through it the way you've been through it. What do you say to them?
Okay, first of all, this is one of the reasons, and I know you've advocated it on many occasions, innumerable occasions, the need for good palliative care, that people know that they do not have to die flailing in pain. That is an image from decades ago. It's time to come into the 21st century and understand, actually, even the 20th century, and understand that all pain can be eliminated. I didn't say controlled. I said eliminated. I know that because in 1995, a Dr. John Scott, Canadian palliative care physician, wrote that all pain can be eliminated. It sounded pretty fantastic, but you know, I quote that part of the book all the time. And I say to people, those words were written in 1995. Can you imagine how much better palliative care drugs have become since then? In fact, what I did is I called a Dr. Margaret Cottle. She works out of Vancouver, but she works in the States as well. She's a palliative care physician. And I said, this sounds like it's pretty outrageous. It was written back in 95. Was it true back then? She said, absolutely. In fact, then she went on to wax eloquent about all the new medical procedures they have, the techniques, not just the drugs, but the techniques that they can eliminate all pain. So my comment to the individual who is facing this is that the supports are there. Ask for them. The emotional supports are in the community. Look for them. Believe in yourself and believe in those around you. It has been my experience, Wesley, that people they wanted to help me. It was very often me that was too proud to ask for it. But in the 40 years that I've had MS, there has never been a time that people weren't willing to help me when I needed it.
And do you think that's what put you on the path you're on as opposed to a path of destruction?
No. It was my faith in God that put me on that direction. But if I was not a Christian, that probably would have, you know, let me give you an example. This goes way back to, 85, like right at 45 minutes. And I've lost my ability to speak. The fellow across the street heard about this, and he came over, and he came into that same office room I referred to earlier, and he just sat with me. Didn't know what to say. But in his silence, he spoke volumes that he simply wanted to be there. Presence. He did more for me than any psychologist could have done because he was there. He's a carpenter. He doesn't have any deep knowledge about the human psyche, but he does know what it's like to be a neighbor and to be a friend. And I will always be grateful to him for that because my friend stayed away in droves. But
That's something I've heard of before. Yeah. Dealing with people going through experience. I had I was a hospice volunteer for a while, and my last patient had Lou Gehrig's disease, and he had wanted to go to Jack Kevorkian for assisted suicide, and eventually, as he said, I came out of the fog and into the light. Mm-hmm. But he said the thing that really caused him to be despairing was the sense that he had been isolated from the world, that he was no longer a part of us, but somebody who was on the outside. And that's what you're talking about, isn't it?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. To coin a part of the lyrics of a song, it wasn't that my friends were unkind, they were just hard to find.
yeah.
Yeah, but that, and I know that that can make a person feel extremely isolated. But then the flip side of that coin is that there are still people all around you who do care. Very often, friends that cease to come around, they just can't deal with the fact that the person they knew that was whole and able-bodied and robust is now not that way. And it reminds them of their own mortality. So I had to take that into mind as well.
Yeah, it can be daunting to go and visit people who are an extremist.
It is,
and we have to. There's always that excuse or reason. Well, I don't know what to say, or I might make things worse. Actually, you can't make things worse if you're not there.
The other thing is that. In my disability, I made new friends. Some of the best friends that I've ever had. You might know one of them. His name is Wesley J. Smith. You met me, I think, when I was either on one cane or two canes.
Two canes.
Two canes. And from there, I can even remember you carrying me upstairs, that you were that willing to help me. Was I embarrassed about it? Sure I was. But you weren't. You just did it.
No, why would it needed to be done? So it was done.
Did I feel like a burden? I don't know. You didn't seem to make it, seem like it was a burden, and the people that were around me that helped me didn't make me think it was a burden. It was me who thought I was a burden, not them.
So we can help people overcome that fear.
Sure.
By helping them in a deeply committed way, and so that they don't think of themselves as an other or as on the outside. Well, we're getting a little close to the end of the interview, but I do want to get to something that is quite unique, and that is what has happened to you in the last couple of years.
What has happened in the last couple of years is I did my last trip to speak in 2018. I came home from that trip, and I got stuck in O'Hara Airport, and I ended up staying overnight in some rather curious circumstances.
We've all done that, and it's never fun.
And when I got home, Laurie said, "You're done. You're not doing it anymore. The traveling's over." And so I sat there, and I was starting to say, "Lord, what do you want me to do now?" And so I was going to before the Blessed Sacrament, and I'm Catholic.
Explain what that is for people who might not know.
To say the Blessed Sacrament is in the Catholic Church, they believe that the Eucharist, the communion wafer, when it's at some point during the
consecration.
Yeah, it's consecrated. And when it's consecrated, it becomes literally the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ, in keeping with the sixth chapter of John. So what the church will do is they will take a blessed the wafer that has taken in on the body of Christ, and they'll put it into a monstrance, which they call it, which is a container, and you can look at this, and in that we believe that there's Christ is in that Eucharist, that host. So that's what I say when I went before the Blessed Sacrament. But I prayed, Lord, if it's possible, could I get out of this wheelchair? Just for a little time. I don't even for a short time, even if it's on two canes or a walker or just for a little time. And I left it at that. I'd prayed that prayer many times before, and with no result. Well, not the results I wanted anyway. And within a couple of days, I tend to get the time frames mixed up because it was so dramatic. One evening, as I was sleeping, it was about 2 in the morning, I was awakened by a presence. It was him. It was as real as if Laurie was standing in the room there. And that presence spoke not in words, but in understanding. By this time, I was triplegic. I had my legs wouldn't work. My right arm was pretty much useless. My left hand was really the only one that was unaffected.
And let me interrupt you just for a second, yes, because I can validate this. I visited you and stayed in your home. You were in an electric wheelchair. This is the last time I saw you at your home. It was probably 10 years ago, 8 years ago. You had the use of one arm. You were unable to go downstairs. You were unable to get out of the wheelchair on your own. You were unable to walk. You'd lost the ability to paint, which you had been an artist when you were young. So I can testify that you were profoundly disabled, and you were afraid you were going to lose the use of your other arm as well.
Yes, it's true. And things got so bad at one point, I couldn't even tie my shoes. I had to be dressed, helped to get dressed. I couldn't cut my own meat. I couldn't hold a fork in my right hand. Everything was in the left, and that was starting to be affected. So I expected everything was going to land up that I would be quadriplegic. But here I was at this night, and that presence said, "Touch your little finger of your right hand with your thumb." Well, I hadn't been able to do that in years. So I was told to do it, so I did it. And I did it. It said, "Touch the other three. Do it again." Which I did. Then, don't want to get too presumptuous here. Don't don't get too excited, Mark. The next morning I got up and there was, we left a writing pad on the kitchen table, and I picked up a pen and I wrote my name. I hadn't been able to hold a pen in 25 years, and my writing was exactly as it was before I couldn't write. Larry came out a little later on, and I did it again for her, and she started to cry. She said, when did this happen? I said, a couple nights ago. She said, why didn't you tell me? I said, I didn't know if it was going to last. And we were just, okay. And then a few days, a few weeks, I can't even, I get confused now about the time frame, because it was so colossal in that happening. I was again sitting at the kitchen table in the early morning, and that presence was there again. My mother-in-law died recently, and her walker was in the corner. And that presence said, again, not in words, but understanding, get up and use that walker. Well, I hadn't stood in years, but I was told to do it, so I did it, and I got up on these shaky, withered, atrophied legs that hadn't been walking for years. I took that walker, and I walked 5 steps. That was colossal. And that was, and I did it again. And then I called down the hallway because Larry was sleeping. And I said, Larry, come out, take a look. She came out and I walked on this with this walker. And she staggered back and again started to cry. Well, 5 steps became 10 steps, became 20 steps. And eventually I could walk down the hallway and back. And then I ditched the walker for canes. Two canes became one. And today, 6 years later, I am walking around the house with no cane. When I go out, walking short distances with a cane. And I would only use a scooter if I go really long distances, because stamina is not good. But I'm walking. This comes from a man who at one time couldn't make the sign of the cross with his right hand. Will that last? I don't know.
You attribute this to a divine healing?
Again,
do you attribute this to a divine healing?
Well, the doctor sure couldn't do anything. My physician sent me to two noted, celebrated neurologists. They did a full workup, did the MRI thing, and all of the stuff. And they were dumbfounded. We can't explain it. I don't know what's happening.
MS famously goes into remission. Could this be a remission? Stages,
but in advanced end stage, no. And I hadn't had one in years. My brain is so riddled with plaque, this should not be happening. But it is. And if I must return to that wheelchair, I did get what I asked my father for. He also gave me something else. And I don't know why I asked this. I said, Lord, when I made that original prayer, I said, Lord, if it's possible, could I dance with my wife one more time? We hadn't danced in decades. One evening after I was walking in a cold winter night, and in Canada it gets cold winter nights, the music was playing in the living room and fire was burning, and I danced with my wife in our living room, just the two of us. It was as though time had melted away. It was like the last time we danced, and we danced to the last song we had danced to before I couldn't dance again, and it was once, twice, three times a lady. And so I have got everything I've asked for. And if I have to go back to a wheelchair now, I will still praise God because he gave me 6 good years.
Well, let me ask a couple of questions on this. Somebody might be listening to this and say, well, okay, that's kind of capricious. God took care of Mark, but not Joe down the street. How do you respond to that?
The task of this life is not happiness, it's holiness. And sometimes it is suffering that takes us closer to God. In fact, it's usually suffering that takes us. But I don't know anybody who wins a lottery and says, gee, I think I'm going to give my life to the Lord because I won $5 million. Nobody says that. But it's when you're at the desperate point where you've got nothing more and you're at your wit's end, and it's only you and the hard edge of reality, when you look up and having nothing to offer, offer what you have, which is nothing, to God. It's at that point that dramatic change can happen and does happen and has happened throughout the ages. That is when we can meet God. And he begins to make us more like him and less like us. I don't know how that happens through suffering, but it is. And I do know that all my whys have been answered in Jesus Christ. And so I would say to that person is, if you're looking for a sugar daddy who's going to deliver you from this and that's it, maybe he would do it. He wouldn't do that for me. Well, if I give my life to God to do with as he sees fit, it is only then, in that the point of total surrender, are we even capable of giving our lives to him. That is the point. Do we know Christ? Not can I walk? Can I see? The whole point is, do we know Christ? And if it is in his will. And when I asked, so 6 years ago, I remembered our Lord's prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane. He prayed three times that he would be delivered from the cup that he was about to have to drink. But he ended each prayer with, not my will, but yours be done. And so if we're able to give our lives to him, that his will would be done in our lives, whatever that might be. When I was diagnosed with MS, I had no idea that I would be. I said, do what you want to do with me, Lord. I had no idea he was going to send me all across North America, from the Yukon to Louisiana, from Victoria to Nova Scotia, from Boston to Los Angeles, and 100 points in between. I had no idea that was going to happen. To take a simple message that we all know in our hearts to be true, that every life is worth life. Does that make sense?
To me, it does. I hope it does to our listeners. We're getting close to the end. I do want to say I was pretty amused about something you told me, and also a little flabbergasted. When you got to walk again, began walking again, and I found out about it, it gobsmacked me. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I was so happy for you. And I thought, gee, there's going to be a march of media to Mark's door to find out what this is about, because it is such an astounding turn of events. And yet, rather than people embracing your, let's call it a miracle, I mean, because that's how you identify it, people have actually turned the other way. Discuss that a bit.
Because you see, people that have only ever known me in a wheelchair saw me walking toward them, granted with a cane, but walking toward them. And they couldn't deal with it, so they didn't deal with it. Even my Christian brothers and sisters would look at me and say, what happened? Was it mega vitamins? Was it? No. God did it. And particularly with secular people, they were looking for the exit at that point, trying to get out. Because to look at it, and there is no medical explanation for it, means that what has happened is a validation that there really is a God. And so they stayed away. And you're right. The Christian media, the media at large, people in the community, they've stayed away because it's just too difficult to accept. I still marvel at it that I'm still walking, but that's what happens. So what I did after I no longer could go on the road is I wrote a screenplay that was loosely based on the reason my life, beginning with the abortion to the miracle, and it's about to go to a production at the end of this year after the producers are finished doing their present projects. So we're hoping that if financing pulls through, that our story will be on either the little screen or the big one.
And what is the name of that project?
Transcend. Because of the being able to transcend disability.
And if people want to hear more from you, you have a blog called Human Life Matters.
That's right.
Describe what you do on that blog and how people can reach it, and there'll be
they
a link
either
in the show.
By leaving a comment on the blog, or they can write to Human Life Matters at shaw.ca, email me, and they can get to me that way as well.
And you're willing to speak and discuss all of these issues.
I'm now at the point where I'm able to speak again on limited terms. I mean, on depending if it's really remote and I have to take a whole bunch of little putter planes to it, then no. But I'm willing to speak depending on where it is.
Well, you've had a remarkable life, Mark, I have to say, and I've watched since we've known each other for about 30 years. I watched your descent in terms of, I don't like that term descent, but your increasing disability. I saw that you, in the midst of that, you became more adamant towards protecting human life, more adamant. As you were suffering more, you became increasingly against euthanasia and assisted suicide, increasingly dedicated to trying to help people deal with these terrible vagaries that can hit us all. And then suddenly to see what I can only, it seems to me it's a miracle.
Or a sign.
Because it defies scientific explanation. I just thought people needed to hear your story, listen to what you have to say, and if they're interested in further discussions, go to Human Life Matters, email you, and particular people who might be experiencing travail. You've been there, and you can talk to them from a position of understanding.
Can I conclude with one point?
Sure.
Never presume the future. Never presume what's around the corner. We don't know. To presume is to play God. We have a life. Live it.
Well, with that, I thank you, Mark, and I look forward to seeing your screenplay produced and what the future holds for Mark Bickham.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.